Quantitative easing, or QE, occurs when central banks, such as the U.S. Federal Reserve, create new money to buy government bonds or other securities. Some people fear that it will cause high inflation or even hyperinflation, and that it is essentially money printing, while others suggest that it has no impact on inflation because the money that is newly created or printed gets locked away in bank reserves rather than ever making it to Main Street, a term for the broad public, or that the printed money is otherwise offset by deflationary forces of debt and demographics. Based on history and math, the inflationary side of the argument is eventually correct, but with a lot of nuance along the way. The best in Bitcoin made audible. I am Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. What is up, guys? Welcome back to Bitcoin Audible. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. We're finally dropping the amazing piece from Lynn Alden. Actually, just the first two-thirds of it, because the second part is different enough that I think it deserves its own guy's take. And this one was brought to you, thank you, to everyone who voted on bitcoinaudible.com/vote. I really appreciate you guys participating in this and making it very clear which one you want to listen to next. And sorry, this one was just kind of a pretty long one, so it took me a bit to get it released. But Lynn does an amazing job of breaking down and specifically steel-manning the concepts of QE and MMT and how they're said to work in theory, then when they are or are not, quote-unquote, money printing, and what their major failures are. It's a really great one for making sense of the macroeconomic situation and trying to wrap your head around some of these really vague and often purposefully obscuring words and kind of getting down to the truth behind what's happening with these. Before we get into it, a big thanks to the Bitbox O2 hardware wallet from Shift Crypto for being my stable rock in these volatile times. You know what's not volatile? My Bitcoin balance on the Bitbox. Actually, it went up during this price drop, which is pretty cool. Get yours always directly from the manufacturer and use coupon code GUY for 5% off. And then how did I make my stat go up? What did I do? Swan Bitcoin. That's right. The automatic plus smash buy savings plan. No distractions, no BS, no shitcoins, no high fees. Set it once and it runs indefinitely. And it would even automatically withdraw to your Bitbox. SwanBitcoin.com/guy gets you $10 free in sats just for signing up. Thanks to both of them. I'll give them a shout out for me for making Bitcoin Audible possible. And with that, let's hit today's read. And it's titled Quantitative Easing, MMT, and Inflation and Deflation, a Primer. By Lynn Alden. Quantitative easing, or QE, occurs when central banks, such as the U.S. Federal Reserve, create new money to buy government bonds or other securities. Some people fear that it will cause high inflation or even hyperinflation, and that it is essentially money printing, while others suggest that it has no impact on inflation because the money that is newly created or, quote, printed, gets locked away in bank reserves rather than ever making it to Main Street, a term for the broad public, or that the printed money is otherwise offset by deflationary forces of debt and demographics. Based on history and math, the inflationary side of the argument is eventually correct, but with a lot of nuance along the way. I've received tons of emails and comments in the past few months from people that want research on this topic to provide a model to think about the deflationary forces of debt and the inflationary forces of unprecedented fiscal and monetary response policies. One thing I've noticed is that the inflation-deflation debate tends to concentrate into the extremes of crippling deflation or hyperinflation. What about moderate or high inflation as a possible outcome in the years ahead? And how about some actual numbers to see how we get to different possible outcomes, rather than just claims of deflation forever or hyperinflation just around the corner. This article discusses quantitative easing, QE, modern monetary theory, MMT, and inflation and deflation, and how they link together. The first part provides several examples of government financing to walk through differences in money flow in a QE or non-QE environment, to tease out what the impacts are and show how some of that QE money does make it to Main Street, not just locked in reserves, despite some claims to the contrary. The second part dives into numbers about inflation to get an idea of how the magnitudes of various policies can affect the broad picture as it relates to inflation and deflation. It sounds wonkish, but having a framework for how this works in plain English can help investors determine for themselves how to allocate their wealth to different asset classes. All asset prices are priced in dollars or other currency units, but those units, the denominator of measurement, shift over time, and we need a way to track it and predict it, and in particular, what events to look for. Part 1. Four examples of government financing. A government extracts taxes from the economy it governs, and then spends that money back into the economy in various ways, with, of course, much debate among politicians and citizens for how much to tax, how much to spend, and where to spend it. In addition, a government of a country can also borrow more money from the public and redeploy it elsewhere. This allows them to spend more than the amount of money they bring in via taxes in a given year. This is obviously a useful option during wars or other crises. However, most countries use debt as a permanent source of additional financing, and thus their debt as a percentage of GDP keeps growing over time, even when things are fine. In other words, they never pay down debt, but rather keep rolling it into a larger and larger base of borrowing. Leverage is like a glass of wine. A little bit can be a good thing. Too much can be disastrous. For some examples of good leverage, a startup needs financing to develop their products and scale their business before they have significant cash flows. A blue-chip corporation generally uses some continuous, low-cost debt as part of their permanent capital structure to reduce their cost of capital compared to a debt-free, pure equity business model. A responsible consumer might take out a low-cost mortgage so that they can buy a house earlier than they would if they had stuck exclusively to cash. And the house often appreciates over the long run and offsets rent expenditure. In other words, modest leverage for investment purposes is fine. It lowers the cost of capital compared to pure equity for mature businesses, and it allows for more rapid build-out of new businesses. When managed prudently, the risks are modest and the benefits are significant. Similarly, if a government uses debt to win a necessary war or fix a crisis or provide a major infrastructure improvement, that can be a good thing. Even when the government carries a bit of debt consistently, it provides the public with a safe vehicle for savings and collateral, for example, the Treasury security market, and basically improves the capital structure of government in a certain way of thinking about it. It can potentially pull forward some scientific breakthroughs or other benefits as well, depending on where the money is spent. However, if an entity consistently spends more than it earns and racks up debt, it can lead to a lack of financial flexibility going forward, or outright insolvency. If debt becomes too large to service, lenders may demand higher interest rates in exchange for higher repayment risk, credit risk plus inflation expectations, and it can cause a death spiral where the debt becomes unserviceable and leads to default or currency devaluation. Sovereign governments that print their own currencies have more flexibility than any other type of borrower. The economics for monetary sovereigns work very differently compared to other entities such as households, companies, or countries that are not monetary sovereigns, such as the Eurozone nations. For monetary sovereigns, nominal default is not the key risk as it pertains to leverage, because they can always print enough to cover their obligations. Instead, currency devaluation and inflation are the risks for monetary sovereigns. They can default softly by reducing the purchasing power of their debt, and so they tend not to default nominally. Here are four models of government borrowing, which help us work our way up and see how QE and MMT fit into the picture as it eventually pertains to inflation and deflation. Model 1. Domestic government borrowing. This is a basic model for government debt without QE or any extra things. In addition to using tax revenue on spending, the government also issues bonds, which domestic individuals and institutions can choose to buy, generally in exchange for interest payments and eventual return of capital when the bond matures. Domestic lenders give the government money, and the government gives them an IOU in the form of a sovereign bond, or a treasury security in the United States. The government then deploys the combined tax revenue and net borrowing back into the economy in the form of public spending, such as military activities, public infrastructure, a judicial system, a social safety net, national parks, public services, and so forth. Each country decides what services they want to be public or private or a bit of both. Some uses of capital have a high return on investment for the public, while other uses of capital have poor returns. Governments tend to roll these debt maturities into the next round of borrowing, rather than ever paying down debt, which can work well as long as debt as a percentage of GDP is relatively stable. In this model, we, quote, owe the debt to ourselves in a national matter of speaking. However, debt is still real. The person or institution that lent the money expects it back with interest and with its purchasing power intact. It's not like everyone lent money to the government. Some people did and some people didn't, and in various amounts. So the flow of capital still needs to be respected. But at least in terms of aggregate funding, it's from the nation's citizens and institutions. When it comes to this government debt, there is no free lunch. The person or institution who lent the money to the government could have lent it elsewhere, or could have used that capital in another way. People describe this as the crowding out effect, meaning that if the government borrows too much from its people, it competes with and replaces a lot of investment they could otherwise do. As some constructive examples, the lenders could have instead spent it on charity, could have started a business, could have lent it to an existing business, or could have put it in the bank, and now the bank has more equity and lending power to other businesses, consumers, and investors. For some less constructive examples, the would-be lenders could have instead stashed the cash under their mattress, or they could buy their own private island and make the world's largest zoo on it and never invite anyone else to see it. All those alternative uses of capital have various financial risks and rewards, as well as personal satisfactions. And then, from a macroeconomic perspective, if done at a sufficient scale, they can affect the magnitude and type of growth in the country. In other words, a nation generally does better in terms of economic growth if people, on average, are putting capital in good businesses and charities, rather than under their mattress or into an unusually large quantity of private petting zoos. The point is, from a high-level view on enhancing national productivity and real wealth and material well-being, lending money to the government via treasury bonds is one particular use of capital, and it has an opportunity cost because it comes at the price of other potential uses of that capital in private markets, which could be more or less beneficial, either for one's own self or from a macroeconomic perspective. An example of a good government spending program that would have been hard to replicate privately is the Interstate Highway System, put in place under the Eisenhower administration. This was useful enough that it's fairly easy to argue that it was worth borrowing and getting it built as quickly as possible to pay down over time, rather than waiting to finance it purely with taxes, because it was strongly beneficial to economic growth during and after completion and gave a big boost to productivity. readers probably don't need an example of wasteful government spending, because everyone has their own list of what they agree or disagree with. Some are more obvious, while others are more debatable. Failed wars are historically among the most notable examples of spending that ends up being far from the peak of economic optimization. But there are a variety of domestic spending examples as well. The main crux of this model is that when the government borrows money from the public via treasury bonds, the money is extracted from some place within the domestic economy and redeployed elsewhere in the economy. Money itself is neither created nor destroyed in this model of government borrowing, just moved around within the economy. Although we don't use any sort of gold standard anymore, it helps to think of this example in gold terms for illustrative purposes, because that's how it used to be, and why this model exists in the first place. The government can't create gold, a proxy for wealth or hard money. It can just tax or borrow gold from the economy that it governs, and then redeploy that gold back into the economy via various expenditures. Model 2. International government borrowing. The previous model was a closed system. In addition to the involuntary extraction of dollars from the domestic economy to spend elsewhere in the domestic economy, taxes, the government extracts additional dollars voluntarily from the domestic economy, selling treasury securities to those willing to buy, and also spends those borrowed dollars elsewhere in the domestic economy. If the government borrows too much in that first model, it can crowd out other uses of that capital and could run out of lenders. And there is a real domestic opportunity cost of that capital. It's just one possible arrangement of domestic capital among the set of all possible options for how that capital could be arranged. However, a government can extend their reach by borrowing from international lenders. This lets them spend money on the domestic economy without first extracting it from the domestic economy, which is a powerful and abusable tool. Most developed countries don't do this much. However, many emerging countries do regularly make use of this model because they don't have much domestic capital to start with. So they borrow money from wealthy foreign sources to start building key infrastructure and other foundations for growth. Prudent emerging countries end up being very productive with that seed capital and eventually multiply it into positive net worth, let's say via good infrastructure and a skilled workforce for starters, which lets them start developing a trade surplus and building wealth. While other countries end up stuck in a debt trap, because they don't use that money very productively, fail to create a trade surplus, and yet still owe the debt to foreign sources. This is particularly risky for emerging markets because they usually borrow in external currencies, such as dollars or euros, that they can't print, meaning that nominal default risk is significant. The United States is atypical because we are a developed country that makes extensive use of international borrowing due to our historical and current role as the issuer of the primary global reserve currency. However, we borrow from external lenders in our own currency that we control, unlike emerging markets that often borrow in foreign currencies. We run persistent trade deficits with the rest of the world, meaning we consume more than we produce as a nation, and therefore send dollars out to the rest of the world each year. Foreigners then reinvest a sizable percentage of those dollars to buy U.S. Treasury securities, meaning they loan those dollars back to the U.S. government in exchange for interest and eventual repayment. From a high-level perspective, in this existing framework, foreigners send us more products and services than we send them, and we make up the difference by sending them IOUs, promises to pay later. Whenever those IOUs are due, we roll them into later maturities. Back in the first example, there is a real opportunity cost to government borrowing because it draws from the same domestic pool of capital that could be used elsewhere. It rearranges where the nation's wealth is, for better or worse. It doesn't add new money to the system. In this second example, though, foreign capital is added to the domestic system in exchange for foreign liabilities, which is why it is powerful and abusable. This can feel great while it happens, because it seems like we're creating something out of nothing. We're able to build extra infrastructure, or improve our military, or promise our citizens extra retirement benefits compared to what they paid in, or generally consume more than we produce. Because we are spending more on our domestic economy than we are extracting from our domestic economy, due to borrowing that extra capital from overseas with a promise to pay it back later, or forever roll it into later maturities. This chart shows the U.S. national debt held by foreign sources as a percentage of U.S. GDP over time. Back in the 1970s and 1980s, the amount of money that the United States government had borrowed from external sources was about 5% of U.S. GDP. The U.S. government borrowing model was still mostly a closed system with just a bit extra foreign capital. By the 1990s and 2000s, it increased to 10 to 15% of GDP. By the 2010s, it quickly increased to 30 to 35% of GDP, which is a large amount of foreign borrowing. Of course, while this can last for decades and feel great, it can't last forever. Eventually, we run out of foreign lenders that are willing or able to lend to us. And the more we do this, the more we dig ourselves into a negative net international investment position, NIIP, meaning that foreigners own more of our assets than we own of foreign assets. A country's NIIP is ideally expressed as a percentage of GDP for proportionate comparison. The NIIP measures how much foreign assets, stocks, bonds, and real estate, are owned by people in a country, minus how many domestic assets, stocks, bonds, and real estate, are owned by foreigners. Creditor nations have a positive NIIP, meaning they hold more foreign assets than foreigners own of their country's assets. Debtor nations have a negative NIIP, meaning they hold fewer foreign assets than foreigners own of their country's assets. For example, as of the start of 2020, the United States collectively owns about $29 trillion in foreign assets, while foreigners own about $40 trillion in U.S. assets, including $7 trillion of our government debt, resulting in an NIIP of a negative $11 trillion. With the country's GDP of a little under $22 trillion, the NIIP expressed as a percentage of GDP is worse than negative 50%. The U.S. Bureau of Economic Analysis keeps track of the NIIP here. After World War I, the United States became the world's largest creditor nation. However, decades of persistent trade deficits, particularly in the 1970s and 80s, resulted in the United States shifting towards a debtor nation, starting in 1985. By 2008, our NIIP was negative 10% of GDP. In just the 12 years since then, due to persistent trade deficits and foreigners financing our deficits, we've rapidly deteriorated to an NIIP that is worse than negative 50%. All those IOUs have added up. This chart shows the NIIP as a percentage of GDP for 32 nations as of late 2019, according to the IMF. This table shows simply that among the 32 of the most wealthy Western nations, the United States has one of the worst. I think only two in this list appear to be worse off than the U.S. on the net international investment position. This second model of government borrowing also works with gold in place of dollars, just like the first model. Money is neither created nor destroyed in this model, although it is brought from external economies into the domestic economy. The government can take dollars or gold from one part of the domestic economy and redeploy those monies elsewhere into the domestic economy, Model 1. And they can borrow dollars or gold from external economies with the promise to pay back later and deploy those monies into the domestic economy as well. Model 2. My article on why trade deficits matter dives deeper into the problems of trade deficits and negative net international investment positions. Model 3. Quantitative easing, or QE. The previous two examples involved extracting existing money, either from the domestic economy only or from the combined domestic and international economies, and redeploying that money into the domestic economy. It has opportunity costs associated with it. They rearrange where money is rather than create new money, and or end up owing foreign lenders a lot of money. In a third example, what if the government has basically run out of domestic and foreign lenders for treasury securities? They've already borrowed a ton of money and can keep rolling those bonds into new bonds. So what happens when they still want or need to borrow even more, and yet not enough voluntary lenders are available to accumulate treasuries? When government debt is equal to 100% or even 200% of the country's entire GDP and still growing, it can be tough to find enough balance sheet space to put all those treasury securities in exchange for dollars. There are always people willing to trade treasuries on a short-term basis, but finding large enough balance sheets to accumulate them is another matter entirely. The government could start a more deflationary cycle of spending less than it borrows, and thus start paying back debt on a net basis, or at least holding debt levels steady for a while. They would likely have to reduce military expenditures, make social programs and other public services less generous, including breaking some existing promises, and/or increase taxes, which would all be politically unpopular among voters. And that deflation deleveraging cycle would likely result in slow or negative economic growth for a while, which often results in lower tax revenues, so it can be a vicious cycle. That's not a commonly chosen path, and it's very painful to unwind what appeared to be a free lunch for a while, especially when borrowing foreign capital. And it's even more politically unpalatable when one generation lived during the era of the borrowing, and the next generation lives during the era of payback or balance. That's a good recipe for intergenerational conflict. Instead, the more commonly chosen path when it runs out of lenders at attractive rates is that the government borrows newly printed money from its own central bank, rather than borrow existing money from the public. When the government runs out of real borrowers of existing capital, they make up new borrowers with new capital. In other words, they initiate debt monetization. A country prints the money to buy the treasury securities that it issues. In recent times, they call it quantitative easing, or QE for short. The United States, Japan, United Kingdom, Eurozone, and others have done this. My favorite source for the definition of QE is the Bank of England, because they are so straightforward about it. Quote, "Quantitative easing is a tool that central banks like us can use to inject money directly into the economy. Money is either physical, like banknotes, or digital, like the money in your bank account. Quantitative easing involves us creating digital money. We then use it to buy things like government debt in the form of bonds. You may also hear it called QE or asset purchase. These are the same thing. The aim of QE is simple. By creating this new money, we aim to boost spending and investment in the economy." In this model, the central bank creates new digital dollars, or digital pounds, or digital euro, digital yen, depending on the country in question, but I'm sticking to the US as my default example, and sends them to the government. The government sends the central bank a treasury security, indicating that they, quote, borrowed these new digital dollars from the central bank, just like they would if they borrowed it from someone in the existing economy normally. For legal reasons, they don't interface with each other directly, but instead go through the primary dealer banks. The difference between this type of borrowing, Model 3, and the normal borrowing from the public or international sources, models 1 and 2, is that they borrowed from a void of newly created dollars, rather than extracting existing dollars from the economy. This then lets the government inject more money into the economy than they extracted from it, and without extracting money from foreign lenders either. It's brand new digital money. This third model of government financing ventures into alchemy, an attempt to create something out of nothing, or transform something without value into something with value. And specifically, this third model only works in a fiat monetary system, where money has no intrinsic value and can be created with a printing press or some keyboard inputs, and can't work with a gold standard currency like the previous two models could. For investors and citizens in general, that should be a red flag. They would do well to pull out and start using what Dr. Carl Sagan once referred to as, quote, a baloney detection kit. Quote, in the course of their training, scientists are equipped with a baloney detection kit. The kit is brought out as a matter of course whenever new ideas are offered for consideration. If the new idea survives examination by the tools in your kit, we grant it warm, although tentative, acceptance. Carl Sagan. The usage of the baloney detection kit doesn't presuppose that something is baloney. It wonders if it might be and checks it. By creating new dollars to fund the government, QE allows the government to spend money on the domestic economy that they never extracted from the domestic economy or even from international lenders. The government still goes through the process of trading treasury securities for dollars, but instead of trading treasury securities for existing dollars from the public, they trade treasury securities for new dollars from the central bank, created out of thin air. For the central bank, the dollars are their liabilities, and the treasury securities are their assets. Back during the 2008 crisis, when the Federal Reserve did this at a large scale, they promised that it would be temporary, that a few years after the crisis, the Federal Reserve could sell its new treasury holdings to the public and erase the newly created dollars. It was framed as a temporary crisis intervention, rather than a new policy of permanent debt monetization. A decade later, in 2018 and 19, it was tried and failed to actually erase these dollars through quantitative tightening. And then they started buying more treasuries, even before the COVID-19 pandemic. In a 2013 article, the St. Louis Fed featured arguments that QE was not debt monetization because the Fed balance sheet would return to normal. Here was their conclusion, quote, so is the Fed monetizing debt using money creation as a permanent source of financing for government spending? The answer is no, according to the Fed's stated intent. In a November 2010 speech, St. Louis Fed President James Bulliard said, the FOMC has often stated its intervention to return the Fed balance sheet to normal pre-crisis levels over time. Once that occurs, the Treasury will be left with just as much debt held by the public as before the Fed took any of these actions. When that happens, it will be clear that the Fed has not been using money creation as a permanent source for financing government spending. None of that happened. A decade later, the Fed's holding of Treasury securities and other assets, both in absolute terms and as a percentage of GDP, are far higher now than they were then and are rising. So it became clear that it was and is debt monetization. The Federal Reserve's total balance sheet, and specifically their Treasury security holdings, keep rising, both in absolute terms and as a percentage of GDP. It's now more broadly understood that this void of new dollars will never be paid back and put back out of existence, but instead will be rolled into new maturities. These dollar injections into the economy came out of thin air and are permanent additions to the system. Carl Sagan's baloney detection kit is already unfortunately detecting some baloney. The temporary nature of the intervention proved to be incorrect. It was indeed a permanent, decade-long and growing source of financing government spending via debt monetization. The next question from the kit is whether permanent debt monetization is a problem. From a legal standpoint, the Treasury does not borrow directly from the Federal Reserve. Instead, they go through intermediaries. The Federal Reserve works with large private banks, primary dealers, who buy the Treasury securities from the Treasury at auction, and then the Federal Reserve buys the Treasury securities from those large private banks or elsewhere on the secondary market. The important point is where those Treasury securities ultimately end up, which in this case is on the Federal Reserve's balance sheet, bought with newly created digital dollars. When the Federal Reserve finances government deficits via QE, the primary dealer banks essentially become pass-through entities. Some analysts suggest that QE isn't really printing money, it's just a matter of creating bank reserves that get locked in a box of reserves and never put into the economy. The QE money never really gets to Main Street, in their view, in other words. And if it doesn't get to Main Street, it can't cause consumer price inflation that critics of QE fear. Although there is some truth to it, the problem with that analysis is that proponents of that view are only looking at one side of the ledger, rather than both sides of the ledger. The other side of the ledger is that the government was able to spend money on the domestic economy via the fiscal spending side that it never extracted from any existing base of money. It instead extracted that funding from a newly created pile of dollars from the Fed, and those Treasury securities are locked away on the Federal Reserve's balance sheet from which it drew the new dollars from. The Treasury Department is the mechanism for the Federal Reserve's QE to get to the public. Things like Medicare, Social Security, military spending, crisis stimulus checks, and so forth would likely have to be reduced if the Treasury was limited to only borrowing from real lenders rather than borrowing from newly created pools of dollars from the Federal Reserve. So a portion of QE money does make it to Main Street, the portion that goes to buying Treasury securities, albeit in an indirect way, based on government fiscal decisions. In other words, the government and central bank working together and with primary dealers simply created new money from a void and spent it, and then put Treasury securities back into that void for record keeping. It's not the void that matters. What matters is where the dollars were spent in the real economy. If that QE had not been performed, then the same amount of government spending would have extracted dollars from the economy, or else the government spending would have needed to be reduced if they could not extract the dollars due to saturating the lender base. However, because this void of new dollars was created instead, the government spending was able to happen without extracting it from the existing system. So, yes, part of QE does affect Main Street, either by maintaining existing promises, like the solvency of Medicare, or by being able to send everyone $1,200 checks and extra unemployment benefits during a crisis without having borrowed those dollars from any real lenders. It makes it to Main Street in the sense that Main Street, in aggregate, continues to receive more government spending than the money they paid in with taxes. And even if there aren't enough real lenders, balance sheets willing to accumulate treasuries, at current treasury rates. However, it doesn't make it to everyone equally. So some people who receive more government services get a greater share than people who do not receive as many government services. An example of running out of real borrowers. So before we get into the example and her breakdown of what happened in September 2019 in the repo markets, let's go ahead and take a break at our sponsor, and we will jump back in on this section. Man, that price is volatile. From $60,000 to $29,000 and then back right where we are today, like $39,000, $40,000. It's almost like if you've been trading on leverage and trying to time the market, you probably got clobbered and had a horrible week. But if you were dollar cost averaging and buying regularly with Swan Bitcoin, you'd have landed yourself quite a great opportunity. This is why I was telling people even before they were sponsoring Bitcoin Audible, Swan Bitcoin is the stress-free, no-hassle way to buy and save Bitcoin. It is a low-time preference, long-term position that makes these drops a gift rather than a burden, and it runs without any maintenance or worry, and even withdraws automatically to your own keys. SwanBitcoin.com/guy will get you $10 in free sats just for signing up. And if you don't like free sats, well, then we can't be friends. And that's just how it is. Swan Bitcoin. An example of running out of real borrowers. The September 2019 repo rate spike was a tangible example of the difference between borrowing from real lenders and creating dollars to fund borrowing when real lenders are unavailable. The repo rate is the overnight lending rate between banks in exchange for safe collateral like treasury securities. Back in January 2020, before any impacts from COVID-19, I wrote an article called The Curious Case of QE that outlined the events that led up to the spike in that key rate. In 2019, the U.S. Treasury was running unusually large fiscal deficits of over $1 trillion annualized, meaning government spending vastly exceeded government revenue, and so the supply of new treasuries was increasing at a rapid rate. However, foreigners had not been buying almost any treasuries since late 2014. Model 2 stopped working, so this extra net borrowing had to be extracted almost entirely from the U.S. economy, Model 1. For several years, that worked, especially because large U.S. banks had so much extra cash from which to buy treasury securities with, as well as hedge funds, mutual funds, pensions, and other balance sheets. And in early mid-2019, foreigners briefly started buying treasuries for several months again as well, which also helped for a while. But by September 2019, foreigners stopped buying treasuries again and became net sellers of them instead. At the same time, most domestic lenders weren't able to buy more treasuries either. Corporations weren't buying. Pensions weren't buying. Insurance companies weren't buying. Traders and mutual funds were only buying a little bit. Model 1 of domestic government financing started to run out of lenders. There were only two real buyers left to fund a $1 trillion annualized rate of net new treasury issuance. One, primary dealer banks, and two, hedge funds. Primary dealer banks buy the treasury securities directly from auction, but were finding themselves unable to sell enough of them to secondary buyers, so treasury securities were rapidly accumulating on their own balance sheets, which only have so much room. They were drawing down cash levels and accumulating treasuries for years. The second buyer still remaining was leveraged hedge funds running risk parity portfolios or other strategies. They could buy both stocks and treasuries with leverage, as long as they had plenty of access to the repo market for low-cost borrowing, which itself is supported by primary dealer banks. Well, in September 2019, primary dealer banks hit liquidity bedrock. Treasury holdings at large U.S. banks had climbed up to a record 21% of assets, red line in the chart below, and their cash levels went down to just 7% of assets, the blue line below, which was roughly a post-2008 regulatory lower limits for liquidity and leverage. So they couldn't keep drawing down cash to buy treasury securities, or lend more in the repo market to hedge funds to keep buying treasury securities either. The result was that there was an acute shortage of dollars in the U.S. financial system compared to the sheer scale of ongoing U.S. Treasury issuance that needed to be bought. The repo rate, overnight lending rate with collateral between financial institutions, suddenly spiked extraordinarily high. The U.S. government literally ran out of cash dollar lenders for their treasury securities, both domestic and foreign. Many people blamed hedge funds, but that was only the proximate cause at best. In reality, the root cause was that the U.S. government ran out of lenders. Foreigners, pensions, insurance companies, retail investors, and finally, large banks and hedge funds simply weren't buying enough treasuries at that point compared to how many treasuries the government was issuing, at over $1 trillion annualized. They had no excess dollars from which to lend to the U.S. government at those rates. The Federal Reserve seemed to have been taken a bit by surprise by the total lack of liquidity in the system, because banks still had some official excess reserves. However, banks need to meet a myriad of liquidity and leverage regulations, so the raw chart of cash as a percentage of assets shows the clearest view, in my opinion. And not all, quote, excess reserves are truly excess when it comes to meeting all liquidity provisions. There were two possible outcomes of this. In one alternative world, the repo rate would have remained very elevated, and repo borrowers like hedge funds basically would have had to stop buying treasuries and even start outright selling them. You can't borrow at a 7% repo rate to hold 2% yielding treasuries on a sustained basis. The interest rates on treasury securities would have had to rise considerably to attract a totally new pool of buyers, such as foreign pension funds, and even that would have probably been insufficient. With interest rates much higher, that would have put massive downward pressure on equity prices and other risk assets, and would have put immense pressure on the U.S. government budget due to higher interest expense and lower capital gains tax revenue. Treasury solvency would have been a real problem, and spending on some combination of Medicare, Social Security, the military, or other things may have needed to be quickly reduced to avoid defaulting on treasuries that they continuously roll over into new treasuries. In the real world, since the U.S. is a monetary sovereign, the Federal Reserve stepped in with newly printed dollars out of thin air and started buying treasury securities due to a lack of any more real buyers at those low rates. For the first 2 weeks, starting the day after the repo spike, the Fed lent newly created dollars to other institutions to buy treasuries with, basically nationalizing the repo market to reduce the interest rates. But when that quickly proved insufficient, the Federal Reserve began outright buying treasury bills with newly created dollars. In other words, the Federal Reserve allowed the U.S. government to keep funding its domestic spending plans at current interest rates without finding new real lenders for their rising deficits. They just created new dollars to buy treasury bills and fill the difference between what the government wanted and needed to borrow and the dollars that real lenders were able to lend. This chart shows the sudden accumulation of treasuries by the Federal Reserve during that time, in green, after 5 years of not buying any and even trying to reduce their holdings, alongside the updated cash and treasury security holdings of large U.S. banks as a percentage of their total assets, in blue and red, respectively. When banks ran out of cash to buy more treasuries, the Federal Reserve printed up some digital cash and took their place as the primary accumulator of treasuries. Months before the economic crisis from COVID-19, the Federal Reserve began accumulating treasuries at basically the same rate they were issued, meaning it was monetizing virtually all net new government debt. That was when the green line in the chart above started to go diagonally upward in late 2019 after the repo spike. Then in March 2020, it went vertically upward as the COVID-19 crisis hit in full force. And again, for legal reasons, the Federal Reserve buys and accumulates the treasuries from the banks or elsewhere on the secondary market rather than buying them directly from the Treasury. One reason that people mistakenly don't think QE gets to Main Street is because a lot of QE just goes to maintain existing government spending to Main Street. The government is spending more on the domestic economy, mainly on Medicare, Social Security, and the military, than they are extracting from the economy. So it's not like when QE occurs, everyone gets new checks. They just get to keep getting the Social Security, Medicare, military defense, and the government services that they are already receiving, which is more than the tax they paid in as a nation. And then in crisis situations, they might also get new checks, like we just saw with the $1,200 sent out to most adults in the country and the big boost to unemployment benefits. So yes, a portion of QE money creation does get to Main Street, the portion that is used to buy treasuries, but it's primarily embedded in funding existing programs and maintaining deficit spending to fund those programs at low rates, so it doesn't feel like it gets to Main Street, and the magnitude is not very large compared to what Main Street already has. We can imagine other hypothetical scenarios for the future where QE money can make it to Main Street, more obviously, on top of existing entitlement structures, if they choose to do so. The $1,200 checks and extra unemployment benefits that people received in the past couple of months were an example of that. Imagine, for example, that the Treasury, authorized by Congress and the President, decides to spend $1 trillion to send every American $3,000 in the next round as a stimulus. The Treasury would issue Treasury bonds to pay for it, primary dealer banks would buy them at auction, and the Federal Reserve would create new digital dollars to buy them from the primary dealer banks and accumulate them on their central bank balance sheet. If we follow the flow from beginning to end, new dollars were created at the Federal Reserve, sent to primary dealer banks, sent to the Treasury Department, and sent to the public, which got deposited in their accounts via direct deposit or mailed checks, which directly increases broad M2 money supply. The Treasury security moves the other direction, from the Treasury Department to the banks, and then ultimately to the Federal Reserve's balance sheet. This is an example of QE truly printing money and getting that money to the public. Similar capital flow models apply for corporate bonds, mortgage-backed securities, or other securities. They wind up on the central bank balance sheet, bought with newly created dollars. It effectively means that money was created from thin air to provide capital funding for a company or the mortgage market, rather than extracted from elsewhere in the economy. New money entered the system. This set of funding doesn't really reach Main Street like it does when QE is used to fund Treasury securities, but it does enter the financial system as it relates to asset prices. So, quote, "Does QE money make it to Main Street?" is not the main question, because it depends specifically on what securities are bought with QE. When QE is used to buy mortgage-backed securities, corporate bonds, stocks, or other things, it mainly goes to financial markets rather than Main Street. When QE is used to buy treasuries in a normal sense, it makes it to Main Street in the form of supporting existing government spending, much of it on Social Security, Medicare, and military. That isn't fully supported by taxation or real lenders. If QE is used to buy treasuries for crisis-level helicopter money, checks in the mail, direct deposits, extra unemployment benefits, negative payroll taxes, or whatever the case may be, then it gets to Main Street more obviously. As it relates to QE in general, once you venture into the realm of creating something from nothing, an astute reader should be using the baloney detection kit. There, of course, must be a cost somewhere. The short answer is that because dollars or other currency units are being created at an accelerated rate, but the available pool of products and services is not necessarily expanding at an accelerated rate, price inflation can follow, meaning that the purchasing power of each dollar declines over time. However, where the price inflation shows up, the magnitude in which it shows up, and how long it takes to show up is variable and goes against multiple deflationary forces as discussed later in this article. Model 4. Modern Monetary Theory, or MMT. Modern Monetary Theory, MMT, which itself is based on an older macroeconomic model known as Chartism, takes QE a step further. Major countries don't currently use this fourth model directly, but they are discussing it more and more, and they already use elements from it via Model 3, QE. So it's important for investors to understand it. In the previously described third model of QE, even though dollars are being created out of thin air, the process still goes through the motions of the U.S. government sending Treasury securities to the Federal Reserve, through an intermediary bank, and the Federal Reserve sending dollars to the U.S. government, again, through an intermediary bank. They pretend that this is a loan, something that could be paid back, when in practice, it tends to get rolled into later maturities forever. These seemingly arbitrary ways of record-keeping serve as mild checks and balances, because they need coordination between the government, the central bank, and private bank intermediaries in order to create currency to fund government spending. This adds a layer of at least partial transparency to the process, and multiple institutions need to participate. Modern monetary theory says, Wait a second. The first two models are built on an antiquated system that involved hard money, like gold. And the third model still goes through those same antiquated motions. But we exist in a fiat currency system. The government prints money and writes whatever numbers it wants on the paper. It doesn't even need to borrow it from the economy, or even from the Federal Reserve for that matter, before it spends it, as it would have to do in something like a gold-based currency system. The only limitation, apart from the current legal structure, is inflation. This is not unlike QE in practice, except that some of the checks and balances are removed. In our system, the Treasury can tax and borrow and spend, while the Federal Reserve can lend but not spend. But if the two work closely together, they can approximate an MMT-like system. In a pure MMT economic model, the government doesn't even need to tax or borrow to spend. It can just create and spend money first, and then take some taxes back out to keep the money supply from growing too quickly, because taxes create a demand for that money, by saying that the only thing you can pay taxes with is that government-issued money. The government could decide to also borrow some money simply to provide a form of nominally risk-free collateral, treasuries, for investors to own. But in this model, they don't have to. If the amount of money put into the economy becomes too great compared to the nation's productive resources, inflation will happen, because more and more money would be chasing limited goods and services. At that point, or ideally before that point, the MMT economist suggests that taxes can be increased and/or government spending can be decreased to take money out of the system, which would put downward pressure on inflation. At the current time within the first three models of operation, the Federal Reserve and other central banks aim to keep inflation and the money system in check through raising or reducing interest rates. In an MMT model, however, the government instead aims to keep inflation in check by managing its spending and taxation, injections and extractions of dollars, so that the money supply doesn't grow faster than productive resources. The MMT approach further points out that usually the economy is not operating at its maximum capacity, and in recessions it operates even further away from its maximum capacity. In other words, let's say steel mills usually operate at 90% capacity, and in a given recession their capacity dips down to 50% of capacity, as demand decreases significantly while the existing supply of steel factories and trained steel workers is unchanged. Well, MMT says that the government can go ahead and do a big infrastructure stimulus and print money to buy a bunch of steel at that point, and it won't cause inflation because there is plenty of capacity to produce that steel. It just offsets deflation. It would only cause inflation if the steel mill was already running near 100% capacity and the government was trying to print money to buy more steel anyway. Steel was the example here, but it applies to everything. Healthcare, education, materials, energy, labor, etc. The MMT model suggests that whenever the country is not operating near full capacity, full employment, and high utilization of existing resources, then the government can go ahead and print money to spend on those areas. Then if the country does get near full capacity of labor and resources and all this new money starts causing price inflation of these goods, the government can raise taxes and/or curtail spending to take some of that money back out of the system. It needs to be more segregated than that, because it's possible, for example, to run out of extra engineers or extra copper and start getting inflation in their prices, but still have plenty of extra nurses or extra steel without much inflation there. It's also worth pointing out that MMT can be used in either a fiscally left-leaning or fiscally right-leaning political environment. A left-leaning system would use it more on the spending side, getting government more involved in spending decisions. A right-leaning system would use it more on the revenue side, and perform big tax cuts when it's clear that the economy is operating far from capacity and that inflation is not a near-term concern. Warren Mosler, one of the initial proponents of MMT, has called for full payroll tax holidays for both the employee and employer side during recessions or periods of slow growth, which would be a massive tax cut, especially for the middle class and for employers of all types. Many critics of MMT just describe it as reckless money printing, but in order to truly critique a theory, It needs to be well understood and explained in its best form, and then debated as to why that best form is wrong or questionable. To intentionally weaken an argument made by an opponent and then criticize that weakened argument is a logical fallacy called a straw man. The opposite of that is to steel man an argument, which means to present the most compelling possible version of your opponent's viewpoint and then explain why you disagree with it, even in its best form. Only then does a debate really get to the real bedrock of truth and understanding. So in this framework, MMT is not just about money printing, but about managing the supply of fiat money in the economy via taxes and spending relative to the productive capacity of that economy, labor and resources, to ensure that there is not too much money chasing limited labor and resources, and that there is not extra labor or resources being underutilized due to lack of spending or high taxes. Someone that is applying their baloney detection kit to MMT can correctly point out that fiat currency is ultimately a confidence game. It only works if people are willing to hold on to it and expect it to have most of its value next year and the year thereafter. The model that MMT economists use is mathematically correct in theory within a fiat system, but relies heavily on A, politicians and other fiscal authorities actually increasing taxes or cutting spending if inflation picks up, and B, that with all of the illusions of fiat money removed and showing what it really is, people will still treat it as a store of value, rather than starting to question its worth if the government can just print as much of it as it wants without borrowing anything. That's my main concern with MMT. It pushes the system closer to the inflationary boundary, which does have advantages, but inflation tends to operate with a lag and can be hard to correct once it starts. The idea that Congress and a sitting president will raise taxes or cut spending in order to tame rising inflation, or worse, stagflation, comes off as unrealistic. And if inflation remains unaddressed with more and more spending, it can quickly turn into hyperinflation and lead to a disorderly currency reset. The QE model can create a synthetic version of MMT if the government and Federal Reserve work closely together, which is what is happening now. My previous example of the Treasury sending out helicopter checks to people that are ultimately paid for by issuing treasuries that the Federal Reserve buys with newly created dollars, with primary dealer banks as intermediaries, is basically MMT in practice. In other words, what people think of as MMT can essentially be done in the current legal framework. However, although QE creates new dollars out of thin air, the process still goes through the motions of pretending to respectfully treat money in the same way it was treated in the first two models, meaning something that has to be borrowed from somewhere before spent and balanced by an asset on the other side, a treasury security that gets locked away on a central bank balance sheet in place of newly created dollars, forever to be rolled to the next one when it matures. For a while, those motions, along with statements by officials, provided many investors reasons to believe that maybe newly created dollars would be paid back. Maybe the Federal Reserve will be able to reduce their balance sheet, and so forth. Those beliefs proved to be unrealistic, but the realization that it was debt monetization is only coming years later for many people, after the temporary nature of it proved permanent when quantitative tightening failed in 2019. MMT, on the other hand, drops a lot of those pretenses of QE and just treats money as something that can be printed whenever unused economic capacity exists. It's not that fundamentally different from QE. It just cuts to the heart of it and removes some of the steps. Although it's not a necessary component of the model, many MMT proponents are also in favor of perpetually low interest rates. The criticism against that, especially from the Austrian economics perspective, is that it makes the cost of money too cheap and leads to high percentages of malinvestment. When interest rates are higher, borrowers and lenders have an incentive to save money, have an incentive to be more selective with their financing and only put it into their most productive ideas, and have an incentive to maintain low debt levels. The hurdle rate for investment is pretty high. However, in a 0% interest rate environment, there's little incentive to save, and there's a lot of incentive to borrow as much as you can to invest in plenty of good ideas, mediocre ideas, and even bad ideas with a low hurdle rate, and to hold a lot of low-cost debt in general to your business, real estate, or other assets to maximize your return on equity and return on invested capital. As we venture into the next business cycle, where central bank balance sheets around the world continue to ramp up to fund government deficits at a scale that has not occurred since World War II, it may start to break some of the illusions that the public holds about money, especially as we remain in an environment where bank accounts and treasuries pay interest rates that are below the Federal Reserve's stated goal of 2% annual price inflation. This sort of currency confidence breaks all the time in emerging and frontier markets. I have family and friends in Egypt, for example, that have learned for years not to hold Egyptian pounds for more than a short period of time before spending them on a harder asset or putting them in an extremely high-yielding bond. A lot of them use accelerated home buying agreements where they channel 7 years of payments into a new condo construction that they own and move into upon completion. But could it happen in major economies, like the United States in the 1970s, where we go back to not viewing the currency as a safe place to store wealth? The second part below discusses inflation and deflation. Part 2. The inflation-deflation debate. All right. We're actually going to stop here today, and I'm going to release, almost done with this section actually in the recording, but not quite, and I wanted to be able to get into Guy's take. So we're going to kind of briefly go over, I really, really love this piece. Lynn Alden has some amazing breakdowns of this stuff, and I also like her perspective on, or her positioning on, like rather than oversimplifying it, let's talk about the actual idea of MMT and QE and what the supposed best case scenario of it is, and then explain why it doesn't work or why it's a terrible idea. And really in the context of MMT is, like, I agree that two main points are that it completely destroys the facade of appearing to have real money, is that it immediately becomes, it tears away the curtains of fiat and makes it so blatantly obvious that this is entirely a confidence game. And what's funny is I think it would lend to the likelihood, or essentially the seasonal push and pull of the value swings. It would create enormous volatility in the actual currency, in the very system designed to make it stable would make it incredibly volatile, because as soon as it appeared that there was going to be any restraint, that the government, which I think that's the silliest thing of all, is that the government is going to cut Medicare or Social Security or spending, or you like stop its military endeavors curtail inflation. There's absolutely no reason to think that that would ever be politically palatable. It's like that is the nature of politics. When has that ever happened? When has there really been any kind of net cut in government spending? That, I think, on its face is really the most unrealistic thing about it, even though there are so many other elements to the problems involved with MMT. But then the other one is that because that facade has fallen away, that this is real money that's being borrowed and then spent or being extracted from the economy and then reallocated according to the government's wishes of what society should be, is that when it appeared that they were going to move for a deflationary mode, that they were going to raise taxes and cut spending, the tendency to immediately shift from wanting to dump your currency as fast as possible to wanting to hoard it will move very quickly. And then exactly in the reverse is that when it's clear that the government is going to go for inflation and is going to push for excess spending and dumping new supply onto the market, is that it would result in a very fast dumping of the currency. Like the facade of any stability in the value of the money would be just stripped away. And I think you'd have incredible volatility just generally. And then the fact that I don't think you'd ever actually see a reasonable curtail in spending, that it would mostly just be for show. And it would look like they would try to make it look like they were cutting spending, but then they actually weren't, to make sure that they've got all of their constituents and all of their cronies and everybody who's getting subsidies and such happy. And everybody just wants to dump it onto the next administration. The fact that there would never be any real political will to increase taxes or to cut spending, I think would just make it, you would really just see the very fast unfolding of the complete loss in the confidence of the currency. It would simply stop being a store of value, and it would just be increasingly volatile, and the velocity of money would be incredibly high. But there's something that I think that's far more inherently absurd about the idea of MMT and the idea of QE and the very nature of manipulating interest rates in order to curtail or expand the economy when the government thinks or some arbitrary metric makes it look like there's extra resources versus uncapitalized resources, is that it's price controls. It's that is the very function of the price in the economy. Going back to the example of not having full productive capacity, if capacity drops from 90% to 50% for some good or service or whatever it is, do you know what's supposed to adjust for that? To figure out where it is that resources need to be reallocated from and where they need to go to? The price of those goods and services is exactly how we get the information for finding out where things have been misallocated. It is literally destroying the very mechanism that is needed to have any reliable information about where value is being created or destroyed, where the misallocation of resources is actually present in the economy. It is the pretense of knowledge problem. It is everything about the use of knowledge in society. It is the pricing problem. It is the reason the price emerges in the market to begin with. We cannot know where capacity is failing or where that value actually still remains. Imagine if this is actually a real shift in the economy. Imagine if this is because there is an alternative that is better than steel in this case, that a lot of what was taking up the steel is now being used by aluminum, and now they subsidize steel to correct for the prices, and now we don't know that we should be allocating the productive capacity and the manufacturing floor, the resources and the infrastructure to aluminum instead. What how the hell is their committee gonna know? What omnipotent geniuses are they going to get who know every single supply and every single productive capacity and can aggregate all of this information, all of which is fundamentally unknowable anyway, because it is time specific and it is specific to the individuals and the values that they are trying to project into the economy, which are only meaningful if the amount of value they put on their monetary transactions means something, if they actually are able to have influence on adjusting the prices of the goods and services that they are willing to pay for. It's flatly idiotic to think that you can get a council of people or a group of bureaucrats or politicians or expert economists or whatever arrogant idiots that they're going to cram into a room to look at a whole bunch of charts to try to figure out what this data actually is. You know what they need to determine it? They need to look at the price. You know what they are doing to fix it? Obliterating the usefulness of the price. Like I've said, I use this example a lot about the plane, that the price is like an altimeter. It's telling us, each and every one of us, in our current situations, our current trade-offs, and the current value of the money and the resources that we have available to us, whether or not we should pull up or push down on the plane, that whether or not we should go higher or we should go lower, because we want to be flying level. We want to be in balance with the rest of the world so that we all don't die. And what they are trying to say is that essentially in MMT and the attempt to create a council or fluctuate and adjust for where the capacity is low or too high, and we're going to make all these adjustments, is to say that we're going to predict where the altimeter is going to go, what it's going to indicate to us, and then we're going to break the altimeter and make it go where we want it to go in order to correct for what we predict its future will actually be telling us. And what they actually need in order to make sense of all of this information is a market. They need the altimeter to have any idea what to decide and how to shift what the plane is doing. It's so hard to explain. You know, actually, here I think this is a profoundly accurate example. It is like taking a perfectly healthy person into the hospital, removing both of their kidneys, and then putting them on a giant dialysis machine and thinking that your dialysis machine is going to work better than your actual healthy kidneys. And now we're going to walk around our lives carrying this giant, bulky, ridiculous dialysis machine around with us, and we're going to fuel this thing, we're going to give it energy, and these will be the bureaucrats who are fixing our problems and correcting and balancing the economy for us, when all we really needed to do was have you not take our kidneys out. That is the analogy that is accurate. That's the stupidity of this sort of a system, in my opinion. And at the end of the day, all four of the models, are essentially a representation of the government taking resources from the mechanisms that naturally tell us useful information about prices, about trade-offs, about the decisions and values that we have as individuals, the power that we have to actually influence the market, and to basically remove those things, is to remove our influence on the market to whatever degree that they are allocating resources instead of our honest, legitimate costly skin in the game decisions. A person who saves money, a person who has earned money, who has had to trade with somebody, has skin in the game decisions. They do not do so lightly. They're far more likely to actually understand and feel, to know the value of that money because they worked for it. And all the same human errors, all the mistakes, all the flaws are still there, but they are connected to skin in the game. They are connected to the fact that we are responsible for our own well-beings. That when we receive assistance or when we help each other, it's not done cheaply or in an entitled way. It is done honestly. It puts the proper dynamics, the proper risks and reward for the decisions. It puts the responsibility and the accountability in our hands. And therefore, it does not disconnect the value of the money from the decisions used to allocate that money. That is why the economy actually works. And inherently, the political system, the government reallocation of this value, does not come with any of those. There is no accountability, or at least incredibly low accountability, probably less as you go up the ladder. The larger the government institution, the less accountability. The more local and smaller, the more accountability. They obviously don't have any real skin in the game, because it's not their money. They've taxed it, they've taken it from people. If their government program fails, oh, well, then it's just that we didn't have enough money, and how dare those stupid citizens be greedy and steal the money from the government. And then, of course, they get their own reward. They get to set their own reward. So if they have 200 times the healthcare plan as everybody else, if they have 100 times the retirement plan, oh, well, that's important. We're just important people. We just must have so much better than the average citizen, because the average citizen is simply below us. It's a very subtle but persistent dynamic. It causes problems in every single thing these institutions do. And the closer you get to just enabling them to print money, the further and further away from any sense of responsibility, any sense of austerity, any sense of restraint of any kind that the decisions of those institutions are. And I think that's why we have seen the progression of just the United States. We've gone from Model 1 to increasingly using more and more Model 2 to increasingly using more and more Model 3. And now we're getting right into Model 4, MMT. Did any one of them really put any brakes on the system, or did it just slow it down from getting worse and worse and seeing the lack of skin in the game and the lack of responsibility and the political push to get something from nothing grow so strong that there was never any way to actually rein it in? Sounds like the latter to me. It's what it seems like. seems like a fundamental imbalance that there is no real solution for. And just like if you removed a healthy person's kidneys and put them on a dialysis machine, it's going to cause these 10 other problems. Now they require their own medication. Now they have to be rebalanced and researched and need their own doctor's visits and counsels to assess and try to make sense of. And then every one of those potential solutions, those half solutions that are just like the dialysis machine and the kidneys, cause another set of problems that will need their medications and their committees and on and on. And ultimately, at the end of the day, we're all fighting over how to harm the organism, whether we're going to create problems that move to the left or problems that move to the right, or whether we're all going to have massive job loss or massive inflation or both. Yay. And all the while, the solution was to let the market itself tell us where the problem is and let the price system balance it. There is nothing about the problems we have today, about where we have arrived, that was caused by free markets. Free markets don't have interest rate controls. Free markets don't have rampant runaway debts with 0% inflation for, 0% interest rates for 11 years. Free markets don't have money printers. Free markets don't have bailouts for irresponsible, insolvent financial institutions. You know what those people do? They go out of business, they collapse, and their resources and their funds and their labor get repurposed to actual productive enterprise and responsible institutions. And now, after all of this, after 50 years of this mess, we're on the cusp of fully embracing MMT in an environment where the idea of cutting the government spending even $10 is basically decried as murdering homeless babies. All I can say is thank God for Bitcoin, because without it, I see nothing even close to a way out of this mess. I see doubling down on every single thing that has led us to here. We will be talking about all of the potential deflation and inflationary environments and where those things might be isolated, where they might creep up first, and what these different models can lead to in different scenarios, even why deflation is decried as this horrible thing, because in a credit environment, it is in fact a horrible thing and is very destructive, but it's a necessary solution to, it's a necessary correcting of a problem that persists that has led to all the debt. And we get into a lot of this, and I'll hopefully have a lot of time for some guys' take tomorrow in part two of this on deflation and inflation. A huge thank you to Lynn Alden for this piece. For anybody who hasn't heard these concepts, I know it's probably pretty dense, might need some multiple listens, but Lynn Alden is absolutely one of the great resources for breaking all of this stuff down. So a huge thank you to Lynn. And obviously, I will have links in the show notes to check out her blog and follow her on Twitter so you don't miss tons of great works. And of course, also we've done multiple pieces by Lynn already on the show. So I'll have a couple of my favorite ones linked in there as well. Huge thank you to our lovely sponsors, the Bitbox O2 Hardware Wallet, for an open source secure place to store your Bitcoin keys, and Swan Bitcoin. SwanBitcoin.com/guy for your automatic savings plan and get $10 free just for signing up. It is the way to buy and stack sats. I stack all the time, stacked in this dip. That's how you do it. Set it and forget it and send it to your keys. Send it to your Bitbox O2. Thank you guys so much for listening. We have another episode coming tomorrow. We'll close this piece out and some really great reads later on in the week. So don't miss it. Subscribe to Bitcoin Audible. And follow me, Guy Swan, on Twitter. And until next time, everybody, take it easy, guys. This has been a 111 production, and you were listening to Bitcoin Audible on the Crypto Economy Network.